The suburbs of all major cities around Australia blossomed in the post-war period, and they were seen as a tranquil haven of normality in the 50s and 60s. Yet the records of violent crime paint a different picture. Author Peter Doyle's uncle, the late Brian Doyle, was an assistant police commissioner in the New South Wales Police. And in his career, he worked on an extraordinary number of violent crimes in the seemingly ordinary average suburbs of Sydney. After his death, Peter Doyle came into possession of a trove of papers that revealed many suburban crimes that have gone unnoticed. I asked him how he came across these files.
I was given access to my late uncle's fairly chaotic personal papers. It was a couple of years after he died in the early 2000s. And he kept quite a bit from his career, and he'd been a policeman in central Sydney in the CIB and in the suburbs. So, yeah, there was a lot of suburbia in there.
And a lot of this information would have been on police files, but not necessarily available to the press of the day. Would that be right?
Yeah, that is right. In his later years, and actually in retirement too, he lectured to police recruits and gave a lot of public talks. He was quite good at that side of things, and he was interested. You know, he liked talking about it, and he liked revisiting cases and some of the nuances of them. So he kept stuff. He was given stuff, a lot of it at his retirement, just carbon copies of some of the files and internal reports on things. So, yeah, there is quite a lot of background and more detailed, finely textured info among his stuff.
And unsurprisingly, I suppose, there was a fair bit of crime in the Surry Hills area. I think Palmer Street was well known as a hotbed of crime. Do you want to describe one of the files that he had from that era, the early era?
Well, in his very early days, yes, he just passed his police cadetship, actually, during World War II in the 1940s. He was a junior detective at the CIB. And, yeah, this is the very sort of non-suburban inclusion in the book, is a murder of a bloke in a back lane in a tiny, squalid little freestanding terrace house in a back lane in Darlinghurst, just behind Palmer Street, as you mentioned, where prostitutes then in Sydney, there was a thing they did, and it was, or some did, and it was well documented in police records. And this was one of these where
was it called gingering, perchance?
Gingering, yeah. Yes. while the client was otherwise engaged, a cohort would tiptoe into the room and rifle his trousers, which had been left on the end of the bed. In this case, that happened, and the bloke went, "Get out, what's going on?" And the two women kind of bashed him with a vase. He was a big guy too, and they were quite short, but bashed him senseless, and then ran round and got their pimps, who were then called bludgers, from the pub around the corner, and they came back and just pummeled the guy until he was comatose. It's quite an amazing sort of outburst of cinematic sort of violence.
Did they get caught in the end?
Yeah, they got caught. It was easy enough to sort of capture them. Their fingerprints were everywhere, and they didn't really cover their tracks that much. It was an interesting case, and the guy remained comatose for over a week down at St Vincent's Hospital, and Brian Doyle, my uncle, then just barely in his 20s, I think, was given the sort of junior cop's job of just looking in on him each day. And he, on day 10, he popped in just to see whether he was any better, and he never was. But that day, he'd suddenly woken up, and he gave a full description of the events, quite detailed. And he died soon after, so the uncle kind of got the goods, quickly wrote it down, took it down in shorthand, and later on in the murder trial, there was a bit of back and forth as to how reliable that supposed confession had been, but the court decided that it was reliable and validly so. So, there were convictions in the end.
But there was a lot of blood and gore, and it must have been a pretty rough introduction for a young copper at that time.
It is extraordinary. He kept, the forensic photos from that aftermath. Numerous copies of photos can be made, but he ended up with a little album. It's like a family photo album, and they're pictures of sort of the shards of the broken crockery and the dusty place and blood everywhere. I mean, it is just extraordinarily violent. One thing that struck me about it was just how, I mean, I suppose this is true of a lot of violent crime. It's just how violent crime can be, just how much incredible rage and brutality can be suddenly triggered by the most trivial of things. In this case, the guy just objecting to having 10 quid stolen from his wallet.
And that triggered, a whole series of horrific events for him, didn't it? Yeah.
Yeah, it did. And one little thing, which I won't repeat the language here, but it's in the book. When he gave his account to Brian Doyle, he said exactly what they said as they were bashing him. And it's kind of salty language, even by our standards, let alone the standards of the day. And the police seem to have delighted in the very respectable, sort of uptight environment of the court. Reading all this out. Yeah, in that case, the language is pretty interesting. I like those little details myself, exactly what was said.
I remember doing an interview with Don Weatherburn, and he actually said, well, look, the stats are that if you look at it per head of population, things were a lot more violent. There were a lot more killings in earlier decades than there are now, in a lot of different ways. And one of the ways which I think captured the imagination was a woman poisoner, which is poison's always regarded as a woman's weapon in a way. The wrong person died, as I recall from some of the details.
Yeah, it's a sad story, that one. Yeah, there was a big poisoning epidemic. Huge, baffling, weird, crazy. You couldn't write it and have people believe you, but it really happened in inner Sydney in the early 50s. But just at the tail end of that, and a lot of people died, and there were a lot of attempted murders, and various poisons were used. But yeah, at the end of that, poisoning was kind of around. If you read the daily newspapers, you'd read stories kind of every day about poisonings, and in this particular one, just a girl in the family, a 12-year-old, I think she was 13 years old by the time she came to trial, was just feeling a bit miffed that her cousin was getting all the attention. He was slightly younger and everyone loved him. She thought her parents hadn't been quite as nice to her as they may have been. And she started adding arsenic to the cooking. She helped her mum in the kitchen. They were a nice migrant family, very decent people, apparently. And she didn't really mean, it was said later on, to hurt anyone, just wanted to give them, just a little bit of quiet private payback. And as is so often the case in poisoning, but then the boy, the little cousin, died. And she was, of course, horrified. And, it was a kind of sad story, actually. And then what to do with her, and the courts wrestling over the decision as to how culpable she should be held. She was then just 12 and clearly didn't really mean any harm, but did do real harm.
And did this really capture the imagination of people of the day?
Actually, Rod, that's one of the cases where, and it's a sort of a theme in the book, in suburban noir, is a lot of these things just came and went. They were mentioned in the paper on the day of the verdict. There were, a couple of column inches, but not that much. And, you can go back to the trial transcripts or whatever records are available, sometimes very extensive, and find, sometimes some quite big human stories there. But at the time, no, just part of the flow, forgotten by a day or two afterwards. I'm quite interested in exactly those forgotten cases as well as the famous ones.
Well, I think one of the ones which should capture people's imagination in just very ordinary middle suburbia Sydney is the Kingsgrove slasher. Do you want to give us a bit of a background on that one?
Yeah, well, that is a weird one. That is the sort of a monsters from the suburban id type story, because it's in the sort of respectable brick veneer suburbs just south of Sydney, you know, Bexley, Bardwell Park, Torella, Kingsgrove, kind of like the...
It's really middle Australia, isn't it?
Middle Australia. You find the same areas in Melbourne and Brisbane and Adelaide and Perth and even the big country towns, just nice places with a bit of lawn out the front. And what happened was a spike in prowling crimes in that area, and then they turned into slashing events. At first, just bed clothes and clothes left on clotheslines overnight were slashed, but then people started getting slashed with razor blades, and women and girls. There was definitely a gendered, you know, an unmistakable gender sort of bias in it. And there were fingerprints everywhere, but they knew whoever was doing it. They were the same fingerprints, but had no criminal record, seemed to know the area very well, and was almost supernatural, the ease with which the person seemed to be entering and leaving houses without anyone seeing him or hearing him. They'd wake up bleeding profusely in some cases. It was really creepy. And when they eventually found the guy, they trapped him. It was a sort of like an early neighbourhood watch kind of thing, a very interesting... This is one of the little bits of information that wasn't at all in the record at the time, but is in the private documents. There was a local citizen helped out the police. He was a bird watcher and naturalist and local historian, and he and the uncle Brian Doyle kind of got together and worked out the slasher's sort of routes of entry and escape, and they were able to trap him that way eventually. Yeah, so when they did capture him, he sort of admitted everything. He was just a local guy. He kept budgies. He had a veggie garden. He was well-liked. He was in all the sports teams, very athletic. You know, he'd been engaged to one lass and hadn't married her, but then he was married. His wife didn't know he'd been going out, at night till dawn, just entering houses and causing mayhem. They tried to pass it off as sort of just some slightly mischievous kind of shenanigans, and he told people that he didn't really mean any harm, that he was just trying to, outrun the police in some way. But, of course, there was real trauma caused. And, in fact, in the trial in the end, it was one of the very early, maybe the first time, that child trauma to children, you know, psychological trauma was really taken into account as a factor. And people were traumatised. Some people got over it pretty quickly, but there were children who were getting psych treatment. That was a rare thing too back in those days in the 1950s and even years later.
I mean, you know, the suburbs were regarded as pretty safe and uneventful in the 50s, weren't they? And it just goes to show, I suppose, that people became very concerned about their what they thought was safe was not safe. So it must have been very disorienting, particularly for people who lived in that sort of area.
Yes, it was. Now, that's exactly right. And it, you know, the nice yard and the mower and, you know, civil society and everything. It was a shock to people. And when the guy told the police that he'd been into maybe 1,000 houses or more, often many times, and had stayed there for hours while whole families were asleep, and they were never and none the wiser, he showed them some streets in Bardwell Park where he'd been into every house. So, you know, that really freaked people out, just to think that while they were sleeping, there'd been this kind of weird guy tiptoeing around. Mm. So, yeah, it quite upset the ideas. Then again, Rod, I must say, you know, throughout the whole book, Suburban Way, you know, like you keep finding that the story of sort of pleasant, civil, you know, ease and amenity, it's not that straightforward and never was. And the suburbs are also, in those days when private space was sort of, private domestic space was a little bit more contested maybe, people liked vacant lots and paddocks and sort of bushland and wasteland. It's where kids had to go to canoodle or whatever they wanted to do. So there is a lot of crime and there's a lot of assault. You'd be surprised, actually, a lot of sexual assault and ugly, awful crime, really. The suburbs were never the sort of...
a haven that everyone thought.
Not that simple a story, not quite.
And I can't leave without touching on the one that did really create a huge amount of concern and change the way that the press was viewed, was the Graham Thorne killing, which was a terrible thing in more recent times, I suppose, the latter part of your book. And it came from a lottery win, a very happy event that was all publicised. But then a little boy, Graham Thorne, got kidnapped and was held to ransom, wasn't he?
Yes, that's exactly what happened. And as they found out later on, he was actually died on day one of the kidnap. So it went, you know, from the kidnapper's point of view, it went pear-shaped almost straight away. But the police and the Australian population didn't know that. So for the first month or more, there was a mad, desperate search for the boy. The kidnapper had gone quiet. He made a ransom demand and then, you know, he panicked, I suppose, and just tried to cover his tracks. But, you know, every policeman in Australia was really looking for him, not just in New South Wales. And, you know, they had a lead, the police had a lead that the likely kidnapper had a foreign accent because he'd rung the household a few weeks before, and a man of sort of, you know, slightly olive skin, you know, black hair had been seen, and they were good leads as it turned out. So there was this pretty intense kind of scrutiny of, you know, of new arrivals in Australia from Europe, then referred to as new Australians, which was a polite term, replacing sort of various racial epithets. But there was this scrutiny of new Australians and this sort of panic moment where people were looking at everybody, you know, every Italian or Greek or Maltese migrant. So it was a very uncomfortable time, and then a very sad time when the boy's body was found in Seaforth in the north of Sydney Harbour. But, and it's also a time when it was Rupert Murdoch had just bought his first newspaper, the Daily Mirror, and he realised astutely that crime sells newspapers. So he put 11 you know, really skilled reporters on it. They were pretty unscrupulous in what they reported. They nearly blew the case by publishing a picture of the suspect when he was arrested, which nearly, you know, nearly compromised the trial. And they also just announced that the boy's body was found before the parents had been told, is my understanding. So
pretty awful all around. It was a shocking crime, but at the time it was a bit of a landmark, and many of the mistakes in the handling of the case, the press involvement, and certainly the way details of lottery winners were then not published in the future, it did change the way things were done.
Yes, they did. No, that's right. They happily announced that the father, who, you know, he was a travelling salesman, basically, they lived in a small flat at Bondi, that he'd won £100,000. Now, you know, this is at a time when a house in Sydney or Melbourne is going to cost you maybe £4,000 or £5,000. So, you know, it's just like an unbelievable amount of money, really, at the time. And, yeah, there's a picture of him smiling and, you know, with his check, and it all... very happy and innocent thing that turned very bad. The other thing, though, Rod, that was really kind of groundbreaking about that trial was because there was such massive national feeling about it and such a desire to first find the boy and then find the perpetrator, it really broke vast new ground in forensic investigation. And I won't go into it now, it's so detailed, but soil samples and bits of dust and dog hairs and hennaed human hair and the, you know, the rug that was found, every bits of seed from various trees and plants and grasses were all analysed, and it turned out very well analysed by various laboratories and universities and the botanical gardens. And that proved to be very, the cops only really had a circumstantial case because the guy denied it. So it all came down to this forensic evidence, and it was a remarkable effort, actually.
Yes, it seems to be a bit of a turning point on a lot of different aspects, the way that things were publicised, the way that things, investigations were done. I suppose it's sort of ushered in a modern era a little bit in that way. But when you were growing up and you had family events and so forth, you knew your uncle was in the police force, but did you have any inkling of the sorts of things that he'd seen and done?
Yes, he didn't really talk about them, but our there were seven surviving brothers from that family, and he was fairly circumspect, as I remember. But the other brothers were very proud of his duties. He was in the newspapers quite often, and during the Graham Thorne kidnapping, he bought the kidnapper back from Colombo in Sri Lanka, modern day Sri Lanka. So he was kind of like a nationally famous figure at the time, and continued to be that. So, but no, of course, he kept a demeanour of manly reserve on those things, as is perfectly correct.
But you'd think that all of those things must have had an effect on him, and people talk about the trauma for police these days. Did you feel that he was traumatised by some of these events?
You know, that's interesting. You say that in his stuff, his notes, departmental notes and reports about the Kingsgrove slasher case. There, you can see that he's affected by it, because in those days, these children had been attacked, and there was no real sort of counselling or no notion of post-traumatic stress, and the mothers, in some cases, had no one to turn to except to him, and he kept getting calls, as the investigating cop on the matter, sometimes months and months later, which he reveals in one of his departmental reports, and where the mother's calling him at one mother who was somehow a single mother, maybe a widow or divorcee. She rang him at midnight one night to say that the 11-year-old girl was cowering behind the couch in the house, crying. A terrible thing. And Brian went there to do what he could, but he was just a family man. He had five kids himself, but, way out of his depth when a sort of post-traumatic sort of crisis situation. And you can read the subtext there that he was very affected by those matters, affected by the effects of these things on other people. That is one thing.
I mean, police training in the days that he would have had it, which I presume is in the wartime days, would never have covered anything like how do you deal with the victims after a crime, the people that are left. Which people these days, there's a lot of assistance in that regard, but then there was nothing, was there?
No, that's right. And really, it's a thing, to their credit, the various Australian police services put a lot of resources into that now, into sort of what you might call pastoral care, for want of a better word. And that's done, with varying degrees of success and conscientiousness, but sometimes very, very high levels of sensitivity and awareness, and it's to be applauded, of course. But that is a relatively recent thing. Even in the 80s and 90s, things were still pretty rough and ready. And back then, it was a world where we have to assume that it was a world full of traumatized people. All those poor people from Europe who flocked to Australia in the 40s and 50s came from theatres of war. There's a level of sort of gendered sexual violence is very high. There's a lot of injured people, a lot of psychically injured people around, and not much wisdom on what should be done.
That's just a taste of many of the stories that author Peter Doyle has uncovered from his uncle's records in his book, Suburban Noir.